Morning. We want to welcome today two groups of students, Manitowoc Lincoln High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we also have West Salem High School students. Would they stand, please? Thank you, too, for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If the students agree to come, they are given the material relating to the case. They come, they listen to oral argument, and then after the second oral argument, they meet with a justice who will describe the procedure of the court in accepting cases and then in deciding cases. The substantive issues of the cases are not discussed. Everyone is invited to join the students and the justice at the end of the second case. Let me introduce the court to each of you. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He is seated next to Justice Patience Rogensack. Justice Rogensack is the justice with whom the students will meet today. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call the next case, which is 06AP2499, Gregory G. Phelps versus Physician Insurance Company of Wisconsin. Representing Physician Insurance Company of Wisconsin, Ian Matthew Lindemann, is counsel Michael Van Sicklin. Mr. Van Sicklin.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Mike Van Sicklin from the Madison office of Foley and Lardner, representing the petitioners, Dr. Matthew Lindemann, and his primary insurer, Physicians Insurance Company. With me is Catherine Smith, who worked with me on the briefs. I think the students tackled a tough case today to get a ready handle on it. At first blush, this case resembles some sort of diabolical law school exam authored by Franz Kafka. It's got layers of complexity added by the fact that this court issued five decisions that are directly on point because of the retroactive effect, as this case has wound through 7 years of prior appellate proceedings and three prior published decisions. Fortunately, I do think the case can be addressed in a much more narrowed focus here. And really, the focus today, I submit, is just on whether the $200,000 award of bystander emotional distress damages to Mr. Phelps is appropriate. And as a corollary to that, whether, as Justices Prosser and Rogensack inquired at the end of the last opinion by this court on this case, of whether it's really sound public policy in Wisconsin to leave a first-year medical resident like Matthew Lindemann as essentially the only category of providers of health care at a hospital that would be outside of the Chapter 655 protections. The bystander,
is that an issue for the court or for the legislature?
I think it's an issue of interpretation of the statutes, Your Honor. I think it's this court's job and duty to interpret them in a way that leads to a rational result. And I will address that.
Didn't the legislature enact legislation after our initial Phelps opinion? Am I wrong on that?
They did in part, Your Honor. It's a newly added provision at 655.002 sub 2 sub C.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to. October of 2005 they introduced it.
Right. And what's interesting about it is it's really not applicable here in a number of ways. One, it obviously is a prospective application statute, so it has no effect as to Dr. Lindemann. Secondly, it's under the sub 2 category of the statute, which makes it optional on the part of the residency program to participate. It's outside the record whether or not which of the residency programs here have opted in. Third, it on its face doesn't seem to apply to the UW residency program because of the exemptions there. And more importantly, is in this case, it wouldn't apply even if it had been on the books at the time, because Judge Sullivan, the original trial court judge in Milwaukee that handled this case and heard the evidence and decided it, he really made several rulings that are directly on the issue of whether that new statute, had it been on the books, would even be applicable. He found that MECWA was not Dr. Lindemann's employer, was not in control of his activities, and was not responsible in any respect for Dr. Lindemann. Conversely, he found that St. Joseph's Hospital was responsible. He made a finding of fact it's at appellate page in our appendix 204, finding number 40, that it was the St. Joseph's Hospital residency program. And again, in his conclusion of law on the next page at App 205, paragraph 4, he found St. Joseph's liable because of the way it negligently implemented its residency program.
So Van Sicklin, was that ruling upheld by the Court of Appeals?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. Yes, because the Phelps family never challenged and appealed Judge Sullivan's rulings as it applied to MECWA. It was left undisturbed on appeal that MECWA was not the employer, and there was no appeal as to the findings as to St. Joseph's Hospital by the Phelps. And that's one of the great ironies in this case.
Didn't this court send the matter back to the trial court to determine the borrowed employee responsibility and connection?
It did, Your Honor.
And what happened there?
Okay. What happened there was the trial court, Judge Franke, decided it. He issued two decisions in which he promulgated, as this court directed, findings of fact. And he did so both from the bench in a long opinion. He addressed findings of fact to all four of the so-called vital questions under the Siemens decision as to consent, agreement to work there, you know, who benefited. Every one of those four vital considerations, Judge Franke made specific findings of fact on. And he did so from a kind of an unusual collage of evidence. This isn't the usual situation where the question of do you give deference to the trial court exists. And I do want to tackle that. But here, Judge Franke looked at the written evidence of exhibits and documents and contracts. He looked at the oral testimony that had been given. He also considered Judge Sullivan's findings of fact and conclusions of law in his decisions, which were law of the case. And Judge Sullivan did see evidence.
Am I correct that when Judge Franke did that, it was a paper review?
It was submissions by affidavits by the counsel on both sides of all of the evidence, but some of that evidence was a paper review in the sense that was presented to Judge Franke that way, but it was oral testimony captured in transcripts.
And just so we follow the trail again, now the matter goes again to the Court of Appeals, right?
Right. And I submit there's at least nine respects in which the Court of Appeals erred in the way...
And that's because they reversed Franke.
Right. In the way they did it, Your Honor, is what's troubling here. It is a question of first impression in Wisconsin of exactly what kind of deference you give to a trial court's findings of fact in this situation. As laid out in the briefs, there's some cases going both ways. The federal courts interpreting Rule 52 of the Rules of Civil Procedure do give clearly erroneous deference to findings of fact made by the trial court, even on a paper record like this. But here it's an unusual posture because both the Court of Appeals in Phelps 1 and this court in your prior decision in Phelps 2 said, as an appellate court, we can't make findings of fact, and directed the trial court to make findings of fact. He did so. He did so in the most efficient way. Instead of having a whole other trial for several weeks, he, with the party's agreement, looked at all of the evidence that had been in the record, including testimony, including Judge Sullivan's findings, which is a bench trial, so he had heard the evidence, put all that together, issued his findings of fact. He did so a second time on reconsideration, very specific facts. And we think those should be entitled to some deference here, not de novo, because otherwise, what point was there to remand it? As you wrote, Your Honor, in the Phelps 2 decision, on the written record, you felt, in Justice Rogensack, that as a matter of law, he was the borrowed servant. And it's the whole case is ironic on this borrowed servant issue, because Mr. Cannon and the Phelps family, in their complaint, an amended complaint, alleged that St. Joe's was the borrowed employer of the resident. They filed a motion for declaratory judgment that he was, in fact, the borrowed employee. All of the evidence that you cited in your prior opinion, it was in the record at the time that the Phelps briefs were filed, alleging, in fact, St. Joe's was the borrowed employer. The testimony of Dr. Lindemann said he was under the day-to-day control of the hospital. The testimony of the president of St. Joe's, Pat Calder, said he was under the day-to-day control. And the testimony of Dr. Kochar, who's the head of MECWA, was to the same effect. The Court of Appeals ignored all that, and I suspect did so in a very flawed way, because, one, it gave no deference. It just completely ignored and substituted its own views of this issue. It then imported facts outside of the Phelps record from a different case, Hegarty, which arose in exactly the opposite procedural posture. In this case, Judge Sullivan, the original trial court judge, found that MECWA was not the employer, dismissed them. Phelps never appealed that determination, okay, and went on to find that, in fact, St. Joseph's ran the residency program. It was negligent precisely because it didn't do what it should have done in controlling and supervising the resident. In Hegarty, it was the opposite. There, the issue was whether MECWA should have been dismissed and was appealed. And it's improper, I submit, for this Court of Appeals to import facts from outside of this record to somehow set aside and ignore the trial court's findings. There's a very different perspective on the issue, for instance, of MECWA. That's very different here than in Hegarty. Secondly, the issue of the attending physician's role here. If you look at Judge Franke's original decision in our appendix, where he made the findings, he found that the attending physicians involved in supervising played a role in the St. Joseph's Hospital program and residency program. The Court of Appeals, out of the blue, perhaps borrowing from the Hegarty decision, makes different conclusions.
Mr. Sicklin, assuming that we can review the record on the borrowed employee issue, turning your attention to the issue that was raised in the amicus brief from the American Medical Association, which there has been some back and forth on, in which the court indicated that it would consider and reserve its ruling as to whether the forfeiture of that argument had occurred. But assuming all of those things and knowing all of those things, does Chapter 655, in your estimation, countenance bystander negligent infliction of emotional distress claims such as the one made by Gregory Phelps here? Why or why not?
No, Chapter 655 does not, in really three different respects, Your Honor. And the first, there's two kind of lines of analysis here. If the residents are the borrowed employees of a healthcare provider, here the hospital, and we submit they are, as Judge Franke found, then the claim is barred in two separate respects. One, it's barred by the post-death cap on all non-economic losses, as this court found in Morin and upheld in Bartholomew. And I'll get into that in a minute. Secondly, it's also barred if the court adopts the lead decision in Finnegan that Justice Sykes authored, and that's discussed at length in the supplemental briefing that this court ordered the parties to engage in. And I submit that Justice Sykes' lengthy discussion of that issue is well-reasoned and persuasive, and I understand that the court split there on a plurality basis and decided it on a different ground, which I submit also applies here, and that is that where you have a bystander claim in a medical malpractice case like this, where the negligence is attenuated in time from what the parent later observes, that as a matter of law, as this court found in Finnegan...
Doesn't that rather go to the common law elements of the negligent infliction of emotional distress, the contemporaneous component of the third element? But directing your comments to the 655, that's not necessary. The common law elements consideration would come after assuming 655 countenances such a claim, wouldn't it?
Yes. That's why I said there's two lines of analysis. If the residents are the employee of a healthcare provider, then you look at 655 and there's two separate respects in which the claim is barred. Under Morin, as a post-death, you know, cap on all non-economic losses, that's really the issue I think is the strongest, easiest basis for this court to decide the case on. Secondly, if it wants to go down and wrestle with the same issue you did in Sykes, I submit that Justice Sykes' opinion is the most persuasive. And then outside of Chapter 655, regardless of whether he's a borrowed employee, I submit that under the common law, this type of claim by Mr. Phelps is barred. Let's talk a little bit about the Morin cap, because that's really, I think, where the trial court made a mistake of law. And this is an interesting case because we have these five Supreme Court cases that are applied retroactively. And so originally when this court ruled, you were probably thinking there was the cap on non-economic losses of all types. Ferdinand comes along retroactively and strikes down that cap. That leaves the resident unprotected. But then Morin comes along in the middle of this appeal and says there's a solitary cap as to all non-economic losses, both pre-death and post-death. That, and under the trial court's correct application here, Judge Franke, that knocked out Mr. Phelps' claim. We agreed that it didn't knock out Mrs. Phelps' claim, because under this court's other retroactive decision in Pierce, she was accepted. And we've paid the wrongful death damages, we've paid Mrs. Phelps and her children. The only issue left is Mr. Phelps, who wasn't protected by the retroactive application of Pierce, and we submit is barred by Morin. If you look at Bartholomew, which is what Judge Franke relied upon in reconsideration to reverse his initial striking of Mr. Phelps' award, it makes very clear, it breaks it into pre-death and post-death caps and said families like the Phelps are entitled to one cap for all their pre-death, pain and suffering and, et cetera. And that's what, in Bartholomew, there was a very substantial period of time where the patient suffered.
Under Pierce, didn't Mrs. Phelps have her own separate claim? And why would that be included in the total?
Mrs. Phelps is outside of the analysis, because under Pierce, she gets her, because she's a patient. Mr. Phelps isn't a patient.
So how are you suggesting that Bartholomew serves to block or hinder Gregory Phelps' claim?
It absolutely doesn't hinder it at all. What I'm saying is in Bartholomew, this court made crystal clear it was affirming that part of Morin which said that there's a post-death cap called wrongful death damages that encompasses all of the non-economic losses that a family or a patient incurs.
Which Marlene and Gregory, Mr. and Mrs. Phelps, received the $500,000 joint award for the wrongful death of their infant son, Adam.
If the family's been paid the full $500,000 in wrongful death damages, and I submit under Morin, as affirmed in part by Bartholomew, that's all they get for the post-death award of non-economic damages. And under 893.55 sub 4, the legislature has defined non-economic damages very broadly, as this court dealt with in both Morin and Bartholomew, to include emotional distress, loss of society and companionship, all of those things, all of the things that Mr. Phelps is claiming from witnessing the death. And so we submit that if he is subject to 655 in this case, he's barred by Morin from getting both the 500 and the additional 200.
Right. If it's barred under 655, if it's not, then he would be, then the award would fit within the structure of Bartholomew.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because Bartholomew said that as to the post-death award, a family, including like the father here, Mr. Phelps, only gets the $500, which he did here.
For the wrongful death.
For the wrongful death, which covers all non-economic losses that were sustained by virtue of the death. That part of Morin was clearly affirmed. What was set aside was the pre-death cap in Bartholomew.
Well, in Bartholomew, we said you could stack, right? Pre-death and post-death.
There, the patient suffered for a long period of time, and him and his family observed that, and they were given all their pre-death damages. Here, it's a stillbirth. It's not, we have a very different situation. So I would like to come back to why I believe, again, that Dr. Lindemann was the borrowed servant of the hospital, because...
Before you do that, counsel, you had the Morin discussion, you also had the Pierce discussion, and then you had, if it's outside of 655, what would be the Bowen discussion, attenuation common law. One of the issues that was that has arisen is the issue of waiver. I'm looking at the Phelps decision of this court in June of 2005, and both the majority and the dissent indicate that the Pierce issue was not briefed or argued by the parties. So that was in June of 2005. Why?
I'd be happy to address
that. Why didn't you list it as an issue? I mean, you had a heads up. In fact, the dissent says not only heads up, but go ahead. And so why wasn't it listed as an issue and briefed and argued as an issue after it left this court in 2005, June of 2005?
Okay. Part of this timing issue is Justice Prosser documented in his Phelps II decision. We did. As soon as there was any notice that there was going to be an argument in this court on the Morin-Pierce issues, we asked the Court of Appeals for permission to do supplemental briefing. At the very end of the Court of Appeals' original decision, there's a long footnote that explains that there was a timely request by Dr. Lindemann to raise those issues, brief those issues. It was raised as quickly as it could have been. And the court said there, we're remanding back, and what's going to happen on remand about whether he's a borrowed employee, et cetera, will tie into those issues. And this court, and so it never was addressed by the Court of Appeals. It wasn't something we could directly raise. And as Justice Prosser pointed out, I mean, we did try to raise it in that sense. And then moreover, let's go a little further. We did squarely raise it in our petition for review here, and it was accepted all issues. We raised the Finnegan-Pierce. It's right up front. And then I think most importantly here, Your Honor, is there's absolutely no prejudice for not dealing with this issue now. It reminds me, I was before this court last year, last term, in the Rouse versus University of Wisconsin Hospitals case, where counsel for the plaintiffs got up to help the patients and said, you know, your court, I just decided to address this issue completely differently than I ever briefed it, never been raised, I admit. I'm doing it for the first time in oral argument, and the court said, well, that's okay as long as we have supplemental briefing where the issue can be explored. That happened, and that's the basis on which the court ruled in favor of the hospital. And here, the same thing happened. We did raise, I believe, all this issue about the retroactive application. If you go through Judge Franke's decisions and briefing, it's filled with discussions about Finnegan, Pierce, et cetera. All of it documented.
It's listed as an issue, though. I mean, that was something. It was never briefed or argued as an issue by you. I think after 2005.
Except it clearly was in the trial court in front of Judge Franke.
Was it listed as an issue?
Dozens of pages. If you go through, and I documented that in our supplemental brief.
Yeah, I read that, but I just didn't. I mean, I looked at the Court of Appeals opinion also of just Judge Curley, right below us on this case, where she notes that the only issue that we address is, we don't address the Finnegan and Pierce cases. That's in footnote one in the opinion.
If you do look at our appendix, I broke it out by subject matter, and the various documents included under subsection B is the remand on the bystander issues, all of which show the consideration and briefing in front of Judge Franke about Finnegan, Pierce, Morin, all these cases. And it's, to me, curious that the Phelps get the benefit of the retroactive application of Ferdinand and Bartholomew and Pierce, but somehow none of which were raised by them any more than us, and yet somehow we're faulted for asking the Court of Appeals for permission to briefing and being told that we handle a remand.
Is Judge Curley incorrect when she says the only issue then in the trial court was the borrowed employee issue? She's incorrect in that footnote?
Yes, she's incorrect in that. I don't think she really phrased it quite that way, Your Honor. It's like the only issue we need to reach.
Given that the only issue remanded to the trial court by the Supreme Court was whether Dr. Lindemann was a borrowed employee, we deem it inappropriate to address what impact the holdings in the Finnegan and Pierce cases may have had on Gregory Phelps, is more especially she raises.
And the whole discussion in front of Judge Franke, and I submit it was correct, is that the remand by this court on the borrowed servant issue only has any, you know, utility if it also, if you find that he's the borrowed servant, what does that mean to the award? And that's where all of the issues on these cases come into play, is on the award side, which is necessarily part of the determination. If he's a borrowed servant, what does that then mean on his $200,000 award? And that's exactly how Judge Franke handled it. He said, I got to decide first if he's the borrowed servant, and if he is, what does that mean? And that's where these cases came, you know, pouring in over the time that were directly implicated here. And again, I submit that you have all of the briefing in the world on these cases now in front of you, the retroactive impact. And unfortunately, the stage here keeps shifting a little bit with the court's decisions, legislative enactments. But Dr. Lindemann still should be entitled to what the law provides, which is these cases apply retroactively. The effect of Finnegan and Pierce, which they got the benefit of, are questions of law. And I submit there's no basis in law or equity that says Mr. Finnegan is denied a bystander award under this court's analysis, but Mr. Phelps gets it. And there's not a useful basis to distinguish the two factual situations. The law is clear in the findings of fact made by Judge Sullivan that at 6:30 in the morning was the last possible time under finding of fact 20 by Judge Sullivan that Adam Phelps' life could have been saved, and that the negligence by Dr. Lindemann all preceded that. Mr. Phelps didn't arrive at the hospital till later. He did not witness the negligence. And there are other grounds for distinguishing Finnegan from this case is that, well, it's a different, allegedly different type of negligence. In Finnegan, it was negligent diagnosis, and here it's negligent seeking of help. But there's nothing in Finnegan that would suggest that the type of negligence has any, you know, bearing on the legal outcome. It's the attenuation. But again, I think the simplest and most direct way to decide this case is again, that he is the borrowed servant. Under the facts of this case, at least, Judge Sullivan found this fact that St. Joe's, it was its residency program, it benefited. It was the one held negligent for not doing a good job controlling as it should have, etc. And that once he is the borrowed servant, and again, I would point the court to the fact that not only does this make good policy, is that it's really what is happening in all of the rest of the country. In the Law Review article that I cited, you know, in my reply brief, there's a really interesting discussion about why it makes good public policy to have residents be covered like everybody else at the hospital. They're really the most vulnerable class of healthcare providers. And they really shouldn't be the only ones that are left unprotected here. So I see them.
Thank you, Mr. Van Sicklen. William and Kevin, representing the Phelps. Mr. Cannon.
Justices, I am Bill Cannon, and I am here with Sarah Koss and Ed Robinson, who assisted me in this brief. May it please the court, counsel, and Mr. Phelps, who is present in court here today. This is the second case in the appellate system relating to an unlicensed resident who, at the time of the incident, was outside of Chapter 655. This anomaly will never occur again because of the legislature's enactment of a new provision in the statute covering MCLA and providing the protection of the Chapter 655 cap and protections to all residents. Not surprisingly, I have a totally different version of what the facts are in this case and the rulings in the various courts. And I think there are four summary reasons that I can give you why this court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision. First, the scope of this court's remand was a very simple, limited remand as to whether Dr. Lindemann was a borrowed employee of St. Joseph's Hospital and therefore entitled to the cap protection as an employee of a health care provider. I believe that that issue has been rendered moot by this court's subsequent decisions in Pierce, Ferdin, and Bartholomew. The only issue at the time of the remand was that Mr. Phelps and Mrs. Phelps had total damage awards of $990,000, $500,000 for the wrongful death, $200,000 for Mrs. Phelps' injuries, $200,000 for Mr. Phelps' emotional distress and loss of society and companionship damages, and $45,000 to each of their two children for loss of society and companionship damages of their mother. The second reason why I believe this court should affirm is that it is quite clear that Dr. Lindemann waived the issue of the validity of Greg Phelps' common law Bowen claims after Phelps won because it failed to raise and preserve this issue before this court in Phelps 2. Consequently, it was not part of the issues preserved on remand. In Phelps 1, they did raise the common law validity of the cause of action after the Court of Appeals decision on the issue of the jury trial and the standard of care. We petitioned this court. They also petitioned. They only raised two issues. Whether Dr. Lindemann was covered under 893.55 sub 4 as a healthcare provider, even though he wasn't licensed. And the only other issue that they raised was whether the Court of Appeals should have addressed the recoverability of the loss of society and companionship damages awarded to the Phelps children.
Counselor, do you agree with opposing counsel that whether there is a valid claim under the circumstances of this case for bystander injuries can be decided as a matter of law?
On the facts of this record, I think there's no dispute that the common law damages of Mr. Phelps meet the standard. There's no issue, in my opinion, on that.
So there's no factual issue. What I'm trying to get at is if If we agree with you, then the claim is waived. We won't even worry about it. But if we don't agree with you, do you agree that the claim can be evaluated and decided by us as a question of law?
As a question of law, I think that there are really two issues here, and you have to address some other issues before you get to that. Do you mean under 655?
Yeah, can we decide whether or not there can be a bystander claim here as a question of law, or are there facts that we don't know, so we couldn't make that decision?
Well, I think there are facts here, but they're part of the record, and I think that once you look at those facts, I think that the issue of law under 655 becomes moot also. And so the third issue here, I don't think there's issue of fact on Mr. Phelps' bystander falling within the Bowen Finnegan. I think that's an issue of law based on the facts, though, applying the law to the facts. The third issue on remand is that Dr. Lindemann never substantively raised or addressed the issue of whether a bystander claim was actionable under Chapter 655. This issue was first substantively raised by an amicus brief of the State Medical Society on August 29, 2008. This court has repeatedly held that if an issue is not raised in the petition for review or cross-petition, the issue is not before us. So I submit that 655 is not before this court. The final reason, and I think this is a major reason why the appeal by PIC is really a moot issue before this court, I think can probably be best expressed with a hypothetical. If Mr. Van Slickelen were to get up today and tell you, you know, back at our brief and our petition in Phelps 2, where we raised the issue of the damages being properly recoverable for loss of society by the children, I've now had a Detective Columbo moment, and I forgot to ask back at Phelps 2, by the way, I don't think that Mr. Phelps is entitled to his loss of society and companionship damages either. I don't think there would be anybody here would say, Mr. Van Sicklen, that has never been raised. As a matter of fact, on the issue of loss of society and companionship damages to your children, you didn't even adequately brief it. And the Court of Appeals held in a footnote 3, the cross petitioners also maintain that the surviving children should not have been awarded loss of society and companionship damages stemming from their mother's emotional distress injuries. The Court of Appeals declined to address this issue on the grounds that it was inadequately briefed. You then said, we therefore deem it waived and do not address it here. So now, if he's saying, by the way, I don't want the loss of society and companionship damages, which is a component of the $200,000 award to Mr. Phelps, addressed. If you said if you raise it but don't adequately brief it, it's gone. Well, then certainly, logically, if you never raise it and never brief it, it has to be gone. In finding of fact 29 in Judge Sullivan's decision, he found that Greg Phelps sustained damages for his emotional distress in witnessing the events that occurred on the morning of November 24, 1998. In finding of fact number 30, he found that Mr. Phelps also sustained permanent injuries from the loss of society and companionship of his wife. In conclusion of law number 6, awarded $200,000 in damages for those two components. It reads,
Although isn't the question not whether he has sustained an emotional injury, but whether it is an emotional injury that this state recognizes as a compensable claim.
But you see, there are two components to the damage award of $200,000 that were never allocated by Dr. Lindemann. And the law is quite clear on that, and as a matter of fact, Dr. Lindemann, when the proposed findings of fact were submitted to Judge Sullivan, and I think it's at the record 174, submitted a lump sum award for all of the Phelps combined of $175,000. So the award of $200,000 that Judge Sullivan ultimately assigned for the two components of the elements of damages were not allocated. This court cannot go back now and say, well, we're going to make a finding of fact and divide them in some fashion.
Loss of society and companionship is one thing you get under wrongful death. And they've been paid $500,000 for, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Phelps for the wrongful death claim, which includes loss of society and companionship and a variety of other kind of damages that are difficult to address. My major concern is not, did they suffer damages? This was a terrible event. Obviously, they suffered damages. My concern is there a lawful claim for Mr. Phelps to maintain here? Not how much damages you want to put in it or not, but is there a claim? That's what I'm concerned with. And I'd like to know how you get around Bartholomew's affirmance of Moran, where we said there's pre-death damages and post-death damages, and the post-death damages have a separate cap, and I'd like to hear about that.
Okay, well,
not the amount, not the cap, but just the claim.
Okay, maybe I need to be more articulate then, because we're dealing with different concepts. The $200,000 awarded to Mr. Phelps was not for the loss of society and companionship arising from the death of his son. It was $200,000 for the injuries to his wife and the loss of society and companionship of his wife that became synonymous with a Pierce claim. That's at paragraph 30. As a result of the permanent injuries sustained by Marlene Phelps from the time of death of Adam Phelps, Greg Phelps sustained a loss of society and companionship of Marlene Phelps and will continue to do so for the remainder of his life. So we're not talking...
That's not a damage that results from a bystander injury. The bystander injury that you briefed and argued was because of the death of the child and the emotional effects on him because of the death of the child. And I'm not saying he wasn't damaged, but I'm wondering, does he have a claim for a bystander injury? Now, the bystander injury is what I'd like you to focus on, and that's what I'm having trouble deciding, and you could help me a lot if you would do that.
Bystander damages are not post-death damages.
Right.
Okay. His damages, and I'm going to go directly to that issue.
So you're saying the bystander damages, just so I'm clear, opposing counsel says they are post-death damages, and that's why he says that Moran still controls those damages in regard to a cap. You're saying bystander damages are pre-death damages?
No, they're damages that arise directly from witnessing the death. They are not loss of society and companionship damages that are subsumed in the wrongful death cap.
Okay,
they're separate damages.
All right. Okay, I understand that, and I agree with where you are. But but by the statement you made, you just told me they're post death damages because they arise from the death of the child. So I'm having a little trouble with fitting them one place or the other.
The bystander damages occur to Greg Phelps as a result of witnessing the extraordinary event here. And maybe if I can just jump ahead a little bit to what that is and how this is differentiated from Finnegan. In Finnegan, of course, there was a summary judgment and decision based on that. In the Phelps case, we have a full-blown trial with findings of fact of Judge Sullivan that are entitled to deference unless clearly erroneous. And the
extraordinary event that Bowen requires, and again, Bowen requires, it's an either-or test under Bowen. Either you see the incident or the extraordinary event. You don't have to have both. And as you'll recall, in that case, Sharon Bowen never saw the event. The third test is the plaintiff must have observed an extraordinary event, namely the incident and injury, or the scene soon after the incident with the injured victim at the scene. Here, the event was the premature birth of Adam Phelps, who was in a breech presentation at 29 to 30 weeks of term. This baby was not supposed to have been born then. Mr. Phelps had been home on the phone with his wife, actually on the phone with Dr. Lindemann also, clearly knew there was something wrong, waited until 6 a.m. to have his neighbor awaken, took his daughter Caroline over to the neighbor's house and ran down to St. Joseph's Hospital and arrived in the room at about 6:45. Marlene, when he arrived, had an urge to defecate and asked her husband to assist her up to the commode behind a screen. He did that at 6:45. She sat on the commode from 6:50 to about 7 o'clock, and at that time, this is what happened. This is the extraordinary event.
Mr. Cannon, you seem to be separating the injury as the extraordinary event when it seems that the traditional analysis requires a contemporaneous component to the negligent act. The negligence here alleged is that Dr. Lindemann failed to seek the advice of a more senior resident or the on-call physician. How do you reconcile those two?
Well, I submit that Mr. Phelps saw everything pre-death, during the death, and post-death, and the issue here was not a failure to diagnose that we have in Finnegan. Dr. Lindemann actually made the correct diagnosis here.
Placental abruption.
And or labor. And in fact, both of those were going on. And he was duty-bound to obtain the chain of command, which his contract with MCCOR required him to do. And
the protocols and procedures of St. Joseph's Hospital.
Well, it wasn't at St. Joe's. It was really directed by the MCCOA agreement.
I know that's your position, but I think there's also evidence in the record to indicate that was St. Joe's protocol, even if it wasn't written.
I don't believe that there was. Anything in writing from St. Joe's.
I agree with you about the writing, but I think there's deposition testimony from a nurse, Barrett, who was an OBGYN unit staff person, who indicated that everyone on the unit understood that St. Joseph's policy and procedure would have required the first-year resident to seek the assistance of a more senior or the on-call physician.
I don't recall that. This is a long record. It's 11 years since the date of the...
Sure. But what I'd like to do is bring you back to the contemporaneous element. How can you separate the injury from the contemporaneous requirement of Bowen and of Finnegan seem to me to play a central role in Finnegan. Obviously, the parent there in Finnegan experienced the horrific event of the child commencing the process of dying while in her arms. But the court there held not too long ago, because that was separated out from the contemporaneous element of observing the negligent act, in that case, the failure of the on-call physician to report the bacterial report in the blood to the Finnegan's physician, no recovery.
Actually, you have the facts absolutely correct on the Finnegan sequence of events, and that's what is different here. In Finnegan, on the morning of the 6th, the parents brought their child in to Dr. Maltini at the Manitowoc Clinic. He ordered a blood test to determine if there was bacteria in the blood. That evening, around 7 o'clock, it was reported back as positive for blood or for bacteria in the blood. That was never reported to anybody. That's the negligent incident there.
Well, it was reported to the on-call physician who failed to report it to Dr. Maltini. The Finnegan's then came back in the next day. So I'm trying to direct you back to the contemporaneous Yeah, and that was Dr. Schutte, who was the on-call physician there, and she never reported it back to Dr. Multini, but that's the incident that produced the harm 12 hours earlier. In this case, we have a continuum of negligence that Judge Sullivan found, and in the Finnegan case, the patients never had any contact with Dr. Schutte. So those are two major distinctions here. In this case, Greg Phelps not only had direct contact on the phone with Dr. Lindemann overnight, but he knew that there was something seriously wrong and came down at 6:45. And this then became the doctor. They knew the baby wasn't supposed to be born at 29 to 30 weeks. They knew the baby was a breech presentation, so if the baby is born breech, there's going to be a catastrophic injury or death. They also knew from an ultrasound on October 20th and November 6th, that's part of the record, that there was placenta previa, meaning the placenta was lying over the opening of the birth canal, so the baby, in theory, couldn't come down the birth canal. But this is what Mr. Phelps then encountered at 7 o'clock, in which I submit is more Bowen than the Bowen test, as Judge Franke also found. I was maybe asking Marlene once or twice if she was okay. She'd say yes, and then just screamed, and she said, "Greg, I feel toes." And I said, "No, you don't." I was just in shock. I said, "No, you don't." She said, "Really, I feel toes." And I walked around the curtain, and that is when I saw Adam's foot coming out of Marlene. So Marlene was screaming, and I ran out of the room, and I ran down the hall and got past the nurse's station, and there was Dr. Pearson. I said, "Dr. Pearson, please come with me. There is something going on with my wife. You need to come immediately." Then I turned, and I started running back toward Marlene's room, and Dr. Pearson was running behind me. By now, part of Adam's leg was coming out of Marlene, maybe the mid-shin or so. Dr. Pearson put his hand on Marlene's stomach and would push on Marlene's stomach and pull the leg at the same time, more or less trying to guide the baby out of Marlene. He did this three or four times, and then Adam came out. I just remember a lot of blood, and there was more blood than I've ever seen in my life. Dr. Pearson cut the cord and then ran out of the room with Adam. I didn't know what to do, so I decided to run after Adam. And Dr. Pearson was a little ways ahead of me in the hall, and he was doing mouth-to-mouth breathing on Adam while he was running. At that point in time, I thought everybody was dead. I thought Marlene was dead, Kyle was now dead, and Adam, my family, was gone. I can't think of a more extraordinary event. This is not a stillbirth, as Mr. Van Sicklen has said. This baby was alive as it came down the birth canal. It was alive at 6:45 when Greg Phelps got there. It was alive at 7 o'clock. It was alive at 7:05 when the leg came down. And it was in the process of coming down that the baby suffocated on its cord and died, according to the findings of fact of Judge Sullivan, somewhere between 7:05 and 7:20.
Justice Brasso. Mr. Cannon, from your past reading here, I think you're indicating you believe you have a strong case on negligent infliction of emotional distress. Isn't that right?
That is right.
But it's a difficult issue. It's a difficult legal issue. And you seem to be arguing that we shouldn't take this issue up. I just do not understand the argument that the other side has forfeited this issue, because they tried to take up the issue of negligent infliction of emotional stress and the new cases on it the first time this came to the Court of Appeals. Isn't that right?
Yes, that is correct, but then they abandoned it and didn't preserve it or raise it in Phelps too.
But In the Court of Appeals decision the first time around, the case was sent back for a trial. I think the Court of Appeals indicated that this issue was likely to come up when it was going to go back for a trial. Why would they have raised the issue with this court in Phelps II if they were
going to get this taken up when it went back for a trial?
That's an excellent point. And the reason is that we have policies and procedures about how you raise and preserve issues in the appellate system. After Phelps 1, where they correctly raised the common law validity claim, we petitioned this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision on the jury issue and on the standard of care. So under the policies and procedures established by the appellate system, and this is one of the most, you know, sophisticated, knowledgeable firms doing this appellate work, and talking about Foley and Lager and Mr. Van Sicklen, I have a lot of respect for him, but it's very clear in order to preserve an issue, you have to petition on the issue or put it in the statement of issues. Now, contrast that with what happened at the circuit court with Judge Franke. After all was said and done, Judge Franke ruled in our favor and found that we were entitled to the $200,000 in damages, but ruled against us on the borrowed servant. We raised that issue on appeal. We appealed that adverse finding, just like Mr. Van Sicklen was required to do, but chose, for whatever reason, whether intentional or not, not to do that. So that's the very simple answer. All you have to do is look at the petition and the statement of the issues, and in order to preserve it under the rules promulgated by this court, you have to put it in there if you want to preserve. You can't bet the farm that the Supreme Court is going to grant whatever it is that you want without you raising it and putting the other side on notice that that's an issue. So that's the simple answer to that.
Mr. Cannon, was the teaching physician here an employee of St. Joseph's? And I'd like that answered by Mr. Van Sicklen as well.
Judge, first of all, that's an excellent question. And first of all, Judge Sullivan found in finding of fact 11 that Dr. Lindemann was an employee of MCWA. He had previously found that MCWA did not have the right to control the details of Dr. Lindemann's work. That's where it stopped. From there, they are arguing, well, that automatically made him St. Joe's employee. It doesn't under the law. They have the burden of coming forward and proving that he was the employee of St. Joseph's. And I know this is a very arcane area of the law, and borrowed servant, I mean, arising from the Industrial Commission times, and I don't know that it really is something that should make a determination here one way in terms of making him the employee of St. Joe's. But there are written documents here. Two sophisticated businesses entered into an agreement, and MCWA entered into an agreement with Dr. Lindemann. And they all dovetail together. Under the agreement with Dr. Lindemann, MCWA became his employer. Dr. Lindemann agreed to perform the duties. This is Exhibit 1, the employment agreement. 2, Section 2. He agreed to perform the duties assigned by the trainee's program director, who was Dr. Cruikshank from the Medical College of Wisconsin, but was also an officer of MCWA. And under 2B, and this is the critical one here, this is, in my opinion, the most important element of where Dr. Lindemann's employment duties sprang from, to comply with the administrative and professional policies at MCWA and the institutions where he was assigned, and then the third and most important one, that he was to participate in patient care under appropriate supervision of senior colleagues, residents and fellows, and attending physicians commensurate with the level of training. And they retained the right to fire. They were the only ones who had the right to fire. St. Joe's had no right to fire and no right to control the details of his work.
If St. Joe's had no right to control the details of his work, how did he get held 20% liable for failing to control his performance that day?
For failing to provide proper orientation.
I thought it was for supervision.
No, I don't believe I can look at that finding. In November, it's finding number 40. In November
1998 St. Joseph's Hospital residency program conducted an orientation for first-year residents that consisted of having those residents familiarize themselves with the institutions as far as where the hospital facilities were located, as well as some instructions with respect to some basics, and that was all. They were thrown into the melee. That's what Judge Sullivan found them negligent for and assessed 20% on. The second reason...
Just so I'm clear, it's your position that there was no negligence assigned to the hospital because they didn't have proper supervision in place for him. Is that correct?
Absolutely, and there are a number of other facts that I can quickly get to.
Thank you.
MCLA and St. Joe's entered into a second agreement. Two sophisticated businesses trying to have this whole setup work in tandem, hand-to-hand. And under the written documents at paragraph 7, it says MCLA shall employ the trainees. Not St. Joe's and not any of the hospitals to where these people are assigned. Dr. Koshar, in his affidavit, also says that the first-year residents are to be under the supervision and control of the patient's attending physician, not St. Joe's. That is not mentioned anywhere. Then the next element is the testimony in this case of Dr. Lindemann himself. He says when he arrived at the hospital in 1998, the Medical College of Wisconsin Affiliated Hospitals was his employer, and he was also asked, because this is an element of consenting to a new employment under the Seaman and Borneman test, have you ever signed any other employment agreements other than the one with MCLA? He says no. He also admitted that the exercise of medical care is his own judgment. Dr. Lindemann, did Nurse Clark ever tell you anything that clouded or impeded the exercise of your independent medical professional judgment regarding the care, treatment, or diagnosis of Mrs. Phelps? No. Question, if you had questions about services to be provided to patients, were you required to obtain guidance or consultation from anyone at St. Joe's Hospital? Answer, no. The nurse was asked the question of where did the residents get their input from? And she responded, this is Nancy Byrne, the resident that's called generally comes out, assesses the patient, and uses his or her judgment on what should be done. And more importantly here, is the request that we have, the request to admit, and I think that Dr. Lindemann is stopped by the answers that he gave in the request to admit. Request number three, that St. Joseph's Hospital of Franciscan Sisters, Milwaukee, had the right to control and supervise the health care services provided.
I'm assuming you're still answering Justice Wilgensack's question, otherwise we're going way over.
Yes, I am, and I'm sorry about that. If I could just add, this is the request number seven, that St. Joe's Hospital had the right to control and supervise the health care services provided by Matthew Lindemann at St. Joe's in November 1988, including but not limited to those provided to Marlene and Adam Phelps. They raise a legal objection, and then they deny that request. And request number nine, that St. Joe's is legally responsible for the health care services of Matthew Lindemann and the care he provided to patients at St. Joe's, including but not limited to the Phelps in November 1998. And he answered by saying, specifically with regard to the Phelps, once the patients are admitted to the hospital through the attending physician as the custom and practice, Dr. Lindemann is under the direct supervision of an attending physician with the services in November of 1998. And so he's never raised the issue of a new employment required. He's never raised the issue that he was an employee or a borrowed employee of St. Joe's. And just to conclude here,
quickly.
We have a situation where the borrowed servant really is an arcane principle that shouldn't be applied in this setting. The Escher case and the Visiting Nurse Association case both hold where a general employer sends somebody to provide services at another location or facility, and that person exercises their independent judgment, he remains in the employment of the general employer, and with good reason, because if Dr. Lindemann is walking down the hall at St. Joe's and turns into the patient room, then does he become the borrowed employee? When he walks out, is he the employee of MCLA? If he's walking down the hall and injures somebody, is he on his own? It only makes sense to keep him under the role of the general employer so that everybody knows where the risks are assessed and you don't have an implied situation contravene two written business agreements. Thank you.
Mr. Cannon, Mr. Van Sippen, you'll get extra time too.
Thank you.
My first question is, unless I wrote down wrong what you said, Judge Sullivan found the hospital was negligent precisely because it did not control and supervise Dr. Lindemann. So unless I wrote that down wrong, I'd like you to tell me where that comes from.
The whole theory of their case, from their complaint to Mr. Cannon's brief about St. Joe's being the responsible, was that it was their residency program. That's specifically found by Judge Sullivan, that it's the St. Joseph's residency program. The finding says what it says, but that's the theory on which that they were negligent in implementing, effectuating their residency program.
So there's no finding of fact that says that?
No finding that says that they were negligent in implementing it because of not better controlling the day-to-day details.
There's no finding that said that St. Joseph's was negligent because they didn't adequately supervise or have a plan of supervision in place.
I mean, it is as reported at finding of fact, 41 and conclusions of law that are cited there, that they did not have, written or verbal guidelines under the residency program, and that they left these residents to essentially threw them into the melee, is what Judge Sullivan found, and he found that. Therefore, the hospital was negligent. So I think it does infer that that's what Judge Sullivan was finding. But
Joe was negligent.
St. Joe, I'm sorry. Specifically address first your question, Justice, and that is on the attending physicians. Judge Franke, the trial judge on remand, made specific findings about the role of the attendings on behalf of St. Joe's. And if you look at appendix page in our brief, 162 to 164, made findings about that. And then in his second decision on reconsideration, I call your attention to appendix page 179. He says, quote, if the attending obstetrician was clearly Dr. Baer, certainly not an employee of MCLA, and clearly someone Lindemann reported to because of the procedures at St. Joseph's. Judge Sullivan's findings indicate that that following the tragedy, Judge Lindemann reported to Dr. Baer and not to any MCLA supervisor.
So was Dr. Baer an employee of St. Joe's?
I think the record is mixed on what his role was in that regard. But he was there as pursuant to his licensing or his contract arrangements with St. Joe's.
I have another question for you. Under your theory, can there ever be a claim for bystander emotional distress in a med mal case?
I think it's conceivable. It's a good question, Your Honor. I think it's where you see the negligence. If let's say the family member was watching the surgery and saw the sponge left in or saw the knife slip and saw the contemporaneous connection of negligence and horrific results, then you would satisfy the test. But what this court in Chief Justice Abraham's decision said in Finnegan was that's the unusual situation. In the vast majority of med mal cases, not necessarily as a matter of law, there's this temporal attenuation between the negligent act and the results. And here, it couldn't be any clearer in Judge Sullivan's findings. He found in finding number 37 that all of the negligent acts by Dr. Lindemann occurred before 6:30 in the morning, by which point it was too late to save Adam's life through any further measures. And then he found in finding of fact number 20 that Mr. Phelps didn't show up at the hospital until later. And so it's a matter of law, in answer to your question, yes, there is an extraordinary, gruesome event here, but it's covered by the single cap for wrongful death damages that Morin recognized and Bartholomew affirmed.
Why doesn't the Bowling case, in response to Justice Ziegler's question, come into play? Because the Bowling case has a three-part test and doesn't require that they be there right at the time of negligence. Bowling was the bicycle, if I recall correctly, and the mother was not there when the impact occurred. Bowling says, number three, the plaintiff must have observed an extraordinary event, namely the incident and injury, or the scene soon after the incident with the injured victim at the scene. Why doesn't that play in?
I guess because the best answer is this court in two separate decisions, Finnegan and Pierce, moved that analysis forward, and very, very clearly in Finnegan, by a five-justice majority, held that you have to have a contemporaneous connection between the negligence and the result. And now maybe Bowen in 1994 could be viewed a little bit differently, but this court, in both Finnegan and Pierce, interpreted it to require that it be a contemporaneous connection.
I never understood either of those cases to be withdrawing any language from Bowen as to this test. I mean, if you would have asked me 3 weeks ago on the street around the Capitol the question of what does Bowen stand for, just because of the facts of Bowen, it doesn't have to be there right when the negligence occurs. Bowen wasn't either. But you're saying those two cases modified that test and withdrew that language.
They certainly are the ones that apply it in the Med-Mal context, and they're the only cases since Bowen that did. And this court's decision in Finnegan couldn't have been any clearer that the basis on which it decided that the Finnegan parents weren't allowed to have their bystander claim was that there was this attenuation. It wasn't contemporaneous. And so it is what it is.
Is it the extent of attenuation? I mean, here in Bowen it says immediately following. And of course, the facts weren't immediately following.
I think the whole idea of there's something different between getting wrongful death damages and seeing your child in the car accident. And here, where the negligent act you're observing happened with the results contemporaneously, here in a Med-Mal context, that's not the case. The negligence occurred because Dr. Lindemann was allegedly asleep in some room, not doing his job. It wasn't something Mr. Phelps observed or even was at the hospital. And then I would like to lastly talk about this waiver. I think it defies common sense to say that there was a remand by the Court of Appeals originally and then later by this court to look at the borrowed servant issue without necessarily inferring that the answer to that question matters. And the answer matters because if he is a borrowed servant, 655 comes into play. And Morin couldn't be any clearer that the type of damage he's claiming, he tries to parse this out. Well, I'm seeking emotional distress. That's different than society. It's different than grief. If you look under the statutory definition in 893.55 sub 4, non-economic damages cover all of those things. And what there's no way to parse out what Mr. Phelps is claiming here from a wrongful death recovery. And so finally, I submit that Justices Prosser and Rogensack had it right the last time the case was here, that residents in this context, on this record, are clearly working under the direction of the hospital. Judge Franke made extensive findings in both decisions, and I think they're entitled to more than no deference, which is all the Court of Appeals did. And so I submit that he shouldn't be the only person treating patients at that hospital left unprotected. Thank you.
Who does PIC insure?
Pardon?
Who does PIC insure here?
In this particular case, it's the statutorily mandated primary insurer. It offers $1 million policy required by Chapter 655 on Dr. Linderman. St. Joseph's Hospital had a separate insurance carrier.
Thank you.
So the premiums for the PIC policy were not paid for by the hospital?
That's a good question. I know the answer. I'm not sure it's in the record. The record is very clear, and the answer is yes. PIC is reimbursed by the hospital. Every single penny of cost under the residency programs, whether it's for laundering his uniforms, making Dr. Lindemann his St. Joseph's ID badge that he wore around, his salary, everything else is passed on to the hospitals because it's the one that benefits. That's the irony of the Court of Appeals argument that the hospital didn't benefit, NECWA benefited by the resident services. At the time he was treating Mrs. Phelps, he was servicing a patient of the hospital was billing the patient, and taking the income it derived from that benefit, and reimbursing NECWA, it's undisputed in the record, for every single penny of the cost associated with the residency program.
But let's say, if I were PIC, would I be getting the check from the NECWA or from St. Joseph?
I don't know the answer in this record, Your Honor. I don't know if it comes through NECWA to PIC or if it comes directly from the hospital. I suspect it may come through NECWA because these residents serve different rotations. The OB rotation was at three hospitals, and then they go to a different rotation. I think it would be impractical to divide that up into fractionalized checks.
You said their responsibility is under Chapter 655. If he doesn't fall under 655, what happens then?
Then we're to the argument under Finnegan that as a bystander claim, it's attenuated in time. And under this court...
No, I mean, you said PIC's responsibility is because he's a Chapter 655 employee, if I heard you correctly.
PIC's on the hook here, whether or not he's under 655 under the policy, and that's why PIC wants to see residents protected. Otherwise, they're susceptible to punitive damage claims, no caps, no protections at all under 655. And even under the new statutory, cap that the legislature has imposed, if these residents aren't covered.
But counsel, with the new legislation that I asked you about at the get-go, and your opposing counsel took a different view of that, I'm talking about 655.022C, they are now... your situation wouldn't exist. Your response is, well, they can elect not to, but who in their right mind would elect not to be covered?
They can elect not to, and you can also have a trial court like here that finds that it was St. Joe's residency program, not NECWA's, and dismiss NECWA. Mm-hmm. Then where are we?
But can you imagine any scenario where they would elect not to be subject to 655?
If they believe through this court's decisions that residents are subject to the responsibility of the hospital.
Well, 655 gives lots more protection to them. I mean,
the hospitals are mandatory health care providers under sub 1. They're not optional. And we don't have then the vulnerability of the residents to a decision by the trial judge that NECWA is not their employer.
I'm sorry, but am I correct or incorrect that under the new legislation, now the graduate medical education programs are entities that may elect to be subject to 655. Is that right?
They are, unless they're connected with the University of Wisconsin.
Thanks. So PIC wants to be held liable here. It's a strange posture for an insurance company.
No, I think we misunderstood the answer.
Okay.
We've insured the residents whether they're covered under 655 or not. PIC is on the hook either way. What PIC wants is protections of 655 for all the types of limits and
limited liabilities
that can flow in without that protection.
That's why they would elect for it. Can't imagine them not electing.
We don't have an escape. We can't turn around to Dr. Lindemann and say, oh, you know, it turns out you're not the borrowed servant, you're on your own.
But the policy... Right, got it. So you want the limited liability under 655.
Just like Dr. Lindemann does, yes.
Good. Thank you. That concludes our argument at last under 06-AP-2599, Phelps versus Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, Inc. I want to thank on behalf of the court, both counsel, for arguing this case with its multiple issues that are interconnecting. And there's, you stated, Mr. Sicklin and you, Mr. Cannon, a bit complicated. That concludes our hearing. The court will take a few moments of recess so that these students may leave and others may enter the chamber. We're in recess.